KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The U.S. bombed nuclear facilities in Iran, joining Israel's strikes against the country. We ask Senator Mark Kelly about the possible added risk U.S. forces overseas now face. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump officials say Iran's nuclear program was obliterated. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel, but outside experts aren't so sure, suggesting Iran moved uranium before the attack and has more underground sites to possibly enrich it. Also, Mahmoud Khalil, the first student targeted by President Trump's crackdown on pro-Palestinian protesters, says Trump is weaponizing the immigration system to chill speech. It's Monday, June 23rd. On this day in 1972, President Nixon signed Title IX, preventing sex discrimination in federally funded school programs. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Brent crude prices opened slightly higher today after the U.S. bombing of three nuclear sites in Iran over the weekend. Iran's the third largest producer of oil in the world oil cartel, OPEC. That's despite U.S. sanctions on its exports. NPR's Aya Betraoui has more.
There are concerns the Gulf's oil and gas could be targeted should the war expand. Iran's Press TV reported that Iran's elected parliament approved a measure to close the Strait of Hormuz, a vital passageway in the Gulf for a fifth of the world's oil and gas, including from heavyweight Saudi Arabia. It's seen as a largely symbolic decision, though, because it requires approval from Iran's top Security Council. Any disruption would immediately affect top importers like China, India, and Pakistan. Dubai-based energy consultancy Gulf Intelligence says two liquefied natural gas plants belonging to Qatar and the UAE are located inside the strait. And it says there's enough crude oil stocks in the world to offset any potential dips in Iranian exports, but only so long as the Strait of Hormuz remains open. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
New York City will hold primary elections tomorrow, and the Democratic contest for mayor is very hot. There are 11 Democrats running for the nomination to succeed Mayor Eric Adams. He is running for re-election as an independent. From member station WNYC, senior reporter Bridget Bergen says large numbers of New York City voters have already cast ballots.
We are seeing turnout rates that are more than double where they were at this point in early voting 4 years ago. You know, there is real attention being paid to the fact not only are the numbers coming out much higher than they were 4 years ago, but also based on our analysis of who is actually voting, the voters who are coming out are also younger.
Bridget Bergen reporting. New York City is also using ranked choice voting for the very first time. A federal judge in San Antonio has ruled that the state of Texas has been illegally placing people with severe disabilities in nursing homes. Texas Public Radio's Dan Katz reports the judge gave the state of Texas and the plaintiffs till August 1st to propose a fix to the violations.
U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia found that the state of Texas for decades unnecessarily institutionalized 4,500 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in nursing homes, denying them appropriate services that are required under federal law. Garcia called the problem severe and ongoing, dating back to a statute Congress passed in 1987 that requires screening to identify community programs instead of automatically institutionalizing people.
And while they're there, we're not getting even minimally adequate levels of services that is required by federal law.
That's Stephen Schwartz, special counsel at the Center for Public Representation. He filed a class action lawsuit 15 years ago and called the ruling a landmark decision. I'm Dan Katz in San Antonio.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Authorities in southern Michigan say people at a church were able to avert a mass shooting yesterday. A man driving recklessly got out of his car and opened fire toward the church in Wayne, Michigan. He hit one person in the leg. A churchgoer then struck the man with his car. After that, at least two staff members at the church opened fire. They killed the armed man. No one else was injured. The social media platform TikTok has banned the hashtag SkinnyTalk following complaints by European regulators. They were concerned it was promoting dangerous and disordered eating. NPR's Katie Riddle has more.
Much of the Skinny Talk content featured dangerously thin women with suggestions around how to lose weight quickly. Now the hashtag is gone, but there is still plenty of content on this platform and others that celebrates extreme diet culture. Experts say part of the reason these messages are so potent, social media isn't the only place people absorb them. Amanda Raffoul studies nutrition and social media at the University of Toronto.
When it aligns with cultural ideas around how we should look or how we should act to look a certain way, that just makes the message all the more powerful.
TikTok stresses that it uses a number of strategies to keep users safe from this kind of content. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
The Oklahoma City Thunder are this year's NBA champions. They defeated the Indiana Pacers last night 103-91 and took Game 7 as well as the NBA title. The series MVP is also this year's league MVP, the Thunder's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, we'll hear from Democratic Senator Mark Kelly on the U.S. strikes in Iran. He's on the Intelligence Committee. But first, Israel has struck a prison in Iran. That, according to Israel and Iranian state media. Iranian state media also says Israel has struck the Fordo nuclear site. The Israeli military has not yet commented. President Trump says Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been obliterated, but that's something that experts question.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN watchdog agency, Rafael Grossi, is calling for a ceasefire.
We have a window of opportunity to return to dialogue and diplomacy. If that window closes, violence and destruction could reach unthinkable levels.
With us now is NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivram. Good morning, Deepa.
Hey, good morning.
So what has the White House said since the strike, and are they worried about any kind of retaliation from Iran?
Well, the president was in Washington all of yesterday, but he didn't have any public events. He did have another intelligence briefing with his National Security Council last night, though. So we really haven't heard much else from the president on this issue. But administration officials like Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth held a briefing yesterday morning. Vice President J.D. Vance also spoke to several of the Sunday shows defending the president's decision. Here's Vance speaking to NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
We have no interest in a protracted conflict. We have no interest in boots on the ground. The president has actually been one of the fiercest critics of 25 years of failed foreign policy in the Middle East, which is why he did what he did. A very precise, a very surgical strike tailored to an American national interest.
And Vance said it would be, quote, a catastrophic mistake if Iran were to retaliate against the U.S. in any way. Iran, though, has said it reserves all options in responding to the U.S. And Iran's parliament also approved closing the Strait of Hormuz, which could impact oil prices. But that decision is not yet final.
And how has the news been playing out in Washington over the weekend? Most congressional leaders weren't even briefed on the attack until after it happened. How have they responded?
Well, predictably, Democrats have been extremely critical of the strike. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, said it was grounds for impeachment. And also, predictably, most Republicans have stood behind the president. But there have been a few that have said that the White House's decision was unconstitutional because it's Congress that has the authority to approve the use of force, not the president. Though I will say it's been decades since Congress actually used that authority. So someone like GOP Representative Thomas Massey, he posted on social media about the constitutionality of Trump's decision. And then yesterday, Trump went after Massey in a lengthy social media post saying he would campaign to unseat him and called him weak and ineffective. But I will say when it comes to public opinion, though, one poll before the U.S. strike on Iran showed that most Americans think the U.S. military shouldn't get involved in the conflict. In the aftermath of the attack, though, it's probably too soon to tell what public opinion will say. But one thing to keep in mind is that President Trump is someone who ran his campaign talking about how the U.S. wouldn't get involved in more foreign wars. Just yesterday, though, the president posted on social media raising the idea that there could be a regime change in Iran, and advocating for a regime change could potentially get the U.S. more involved in a conflict that there might not be public support for.
The president is supposed to leave tomorrow for the NATO summit in the Netherlands. How is Trump's decision going to come up among European allies? How do you think it's going to play out?
Yeah, well, there are some NATO allies who have spoken out about the threat of Iran's nuclear program already. So it's possible that Trump receives some support from European allies about his decision to strike Iran. For example, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer posted on X and said that the U.S. took action to alleviate the threat of Iran's nuclear program. But I will say the main focus of the summit will be trying to get NATO members to spend more on their defense, which is something Trump has been really critical about for years.
That is NPR's Deepa Shivram. Deepa, thank you.
Thank you.
As we've just heard from Deepa, Democrats and a few Republicans are demanding answers about President Trump's decision to use military force against Iran. The Republican leadership in both the House and Senate backed the president. Democratic leaders, however, condemned the strikes and questioned whether attacking Iran without the advice and consent of Congress was constitutional. Democratic Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona serves on the Senate Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. He's also a combat veteran who flew missions as a naval aviator in the Gulf War. Senator Kelly, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Good morning, Michelle.
So over the weekend, you noted that Iran is, you said, enriching uranium more than what they would need for power generation, so that they were in process. They were doing something that the U.S. and, of course, other allies don't want them to do. But you also said that there was no clear present immediate danger to the U.S. and to our troops and even to Israel with regards to nuclear capability. You said that this did not have to be done this way. But if it was effective in halting or slowing down Iran's nuclear capability, what's wrong with it?
Well, it also might speed up their race to get a nuclear weapon. They were not actually building a weapon. Our big concern was the amount of enriched uranium that they had, which, as you noted, was much more than what they needed for a civilian nuclear power. Hey, Michelle, this was a big gamble. We don't know what the end game is here. They didn't get authorization from Congress, as they should. And previous presidents chose not to do this because of the risk of getting into a wider regional war. So in my view, this was a mistake. It did not have to be done now. It puts our troops at risk. And as I mentioned that you saw, there was no imminent threat to the United States.
So it's customary, and some might argue it's required, for the president to at least consult the so-called Gang of Eight. That's the leaders of the House and Senate from both parties. It's the ranking members of the Intelligence Committee from both parties on both the House and Senate side. The reporting suggests that did not happen, that a few key Republicans were notified, but no Democrats were. If that is true, what's the recourse that the Democratic leaders have here?
Well, this administration operates outside of any norms frequently. So I'm not surprised that this is the way that they conducted themselves. But going forward here, we've got to, recourse on that, there's probably not a lot we can do. But we can continue to push this administration on a authorization of use of military force, which they should have done initially, to tell us, okay, what is now the current goal here? What is the plan that they have going forward? How are we going to protect our troops in the region? What's the regional posture going to be? The Iranians at any moment now could attack Americans. That wasn't a risk we had before this strike was conducted. And my biggest, you know, worry here is, even though we tried to set them back in developing a nuclear weapon, this could be the moment that they make a decision to start building a bomb and further enriching that uranium.
If the Democrats have no recourse here, what incentive does the administration have to consult with them in the future?
Well, they should comply with the Constitution. And traditionally, presidents have done that. I know recently, sometimes with certain actions, when it is viewed as protecting, you know, the safety of our country, presidents can act, and then they should be able to notify us. But this, in my view, I mean, listen to what J.D. Vance said the other day, right? He said, we're not at war with Iran. We are at war with Iran's nuclear program. It's the same thing.
So let me ask you about this, that J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth all said yesterday that the administration did not want regime change in Iran. But then President Trump posted on social media that if the current regime is unable to make Iran great again, why wouldn't there be regime change? How do you understand that?
Well, I understand it as the president is open to regime change. Now, whether he will, you know, try to push Iran in that direction is another question. I'm sure the Israelis would like to see that. You know, this is a dangerous moment, with no end game in mind.
That is Democratic Senator Mark Kelly. He's a Democrat from Arizona, and as we said, he's a combat veteran himself. Senator Kelly, thanks so much for joining us, and I do hope we'll talk again. This is obviously a very important and ongoing story.
All right. Thank you.
People in Iran are afraid the war is intensifying now that the U.S. is involved. NPR's Arzu Rizvani has been exchanging messages with some of them who asked not to use full names for fear of government retribution. She brings us their voices.
It was early Sunday morning when 24-year-old Yeganeh, a hairdresser who lives in the northeastern city of Mashhad, learned the U.S. bombed her country overnight.
When I woke up, my sister first told me of the news, and I instantly felt a pit in my stomach, an intense terror. I couldn't find the words and was just speechless. It's a feeling I hope no one, not in the U.S. or anyone in the world, will ever experience.
For 40-year-old Puya, the war upended what was meant to be a quick business trip to Iran and a visit with his mother, who's been very sick. He was supposed to leave the country over the weekend, but instead of getting out, U.S. bombers flew in, hitting three uranium enrichment sites and unleashing fears that the war Israel started 11 days ago is rapidly expanding and intensifying. He says he's not confident Iran's government can protect its people.
People feel somehow forgotten because of the government, and not only appears incapable of defending the country or itself, but it has failed to manage the whole situation, just somehow to facilitate evacuation or issue any public alarms.
President Trump has warned Iran not to retaliate against the U.S. That hasn't stopped Iran from issuing its own warning. In a video published overnight, a spokesman for the military's Revolutionary Guard Corps says the U.S. will face, quote, regrettable and unpredictable consequences. His final words were in English.
Gambler Trump, you can start this war, but we will be the ones who end it.
Gambler Trump, he says, you can start this war, but we'll be the ones who end it. For Iranians like V, an engineer living in Tehran, the future feels grim.
I think we've reached the point of no return, and I don't believe that logical and sane people are in charge, neither in Iran nor in Israel or in the U.S.
Iranians are now waiting to see if the rhetoric is real. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, journalist Carter Sherman joins us to talk about her new book, The Second Coming, Sex and the Next Generation's Fight Over Its Future. She explores why Gen Z is having less sex, how the internet, politics, and miseducation are shaping intimacy, and what it all means for the future. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, who certify designers' work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. After 104 days in detention, Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil is now free on bail. Khalil became the face of the Trump administration's crackdown on students protesting against Israel's war in Gaza. He was the first of several students detained across the country this year, whisked away by immigration agents who he says didn't look or act like federal agents when they picked him up in the lobby of his student housing one evening.
It felt like kidnapping, to be honest. You have plainclothes agents in unmarked cars, not identifying themselves, claiming to have an arrest warrant that they did not show.
The Trump administration kept Khalil behind bars in Louisiana, nearly 1,400 miles away from his home in New York City. That's where his wife, who was 8 months pregnant when he was detained, eventually gave birth to their baby boy without Khalil by her side.
Missing the birth of Dean, I believe that was the most tragic event that happened to me in my life. Mm-hmm. And last month, after so much pressure, they allowed me to hold him for an hour. So this time felt, of course, different. It's just very mixed feelings.
What do you mean mixed feelings?
I was in shock. Like, is this really happening? Am I daydreaming? But also mixed feelings about the hundreds of fathers in the detention center, that there's no, absolutely no reason why they cannot hold their children. In some way, I felt that now I defeated Trump. They wanted to separate me from my family, but they failed.
Can you say more about that? I mean, this is an administration that has said very clearly that they think that the protests are bad, that they're anti-Semitic, and that they will continue to deport and detain students.
They want the protests to stop because it exposes this administration's and government hypocrisy when it comes to human rights. In my case, they weaponized the immigration system to achieve what they want to, which is to chill speech. And Trump basically thinks that he creates the law and people should follow. So the fact that the federal judge ordered my release meant that Trump is basically no king.
The administration has already, the Department of Homeland Security already tweeted out that they filed an appeal on your release. So far, the government has not accused you of breaking any laws in these court documents, but administration officials have repeated on our air, on other media outlets, that you were involved with anti-Semitic activities, that you were agitating and supporting Hamas. I mean, have they shown you or told you specifically what you said or did that they say constitutes supporting Hamas or inciting anti-Semitism?
They absolutely showed me nothing. They had the opportunity to do that for over 100 days. And I dare Trump, Rubio, and their administration to substantiate these claims, because they did not refer to anything. Even when they say, I distributed the flyers, okay, show us the photos that I did that. Like, just the bare minimum. And what they are depending on is hateful rhetoric trying to portray me as a villain so that people don't actually look at what I was actually doing, what I was actually saying, what my values are, what my speech is about. That's why they use the immigration system, because if they had a case, they would have either gone to a criminal system, civil system, but they know they don't have a case. They had to go back to literally 1952 to justify my deportation.
Which is this immigration act that says, like, the Secretary of State can remove a person that they deem adverse to foreign policy.
Exactly.
Where does your case stand now?
My release is just a first step. The legal fight is still very, very long. The administration had appealed the decision about my release. Mm-hmm. But then we will prove our case that what happened to Mahmoud Khalil was textbook retaliation on First Amendment, that I was targeted because of my speech. I want to make sure that everyone who had contributed to my arrest will be held accountable. So this is something I'm also looking forward to, because now I can defend myself. While in detention, the administration had refused any opportunity for me to speak to media, because they know that they have no case. They were basically fearing my voice.
You mean they actively stopped you from speaking to journalists while in detention?
Yes, they did. A number of media outlets reached out to the facility asking for interviews with me, but they basically either deny or ignore these requests. So I had to depend on reciting op-eds through the phone in order to get my voice out.
Do you think you'll be able to stay with your family?
I will fight to do that, as everyone should, to be with their families. That's why I'm standing up against this administration, to remain with my family, but also to give other children a chance of being with their family, because the U.S. tax dollars is being now used to kill fathers and babies back in Palestine. They are being used to separate families here in the United States under the watch of everyone. That's what I will continue to be fighting.
Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student who was detained for 104 days, now free on bail, joining us from New York City. Thank you, Mahmoud, for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, Trisha McLaughlin, told NPR that Khalil's detention was legal. She also urged Khalil, a legal permanent resident, to self-deport. The White House told NPR it, quote, looks forward, unquote, to removing him from the U.S. They both said they expected to win on appeal. Neither provided evidence for their claims that Khalil supported Hamas or incited anti-Semitism. This is NPR News.
This spring, a huge algal bloom off the coast of California produced a toxin that would end up sickening thousands of marine mammals.
Most of our facilities have done what they would do in a year in the first 3 months of this year.
I'm Elsa Chang. How scientists are helping some of these animals heal while preparing for another outbreak. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Israeli forces say they carried out more airstrikes in Iran today. Israel describes these latest strikes as the most intense bombing of Tehran since Israel began attacking Iran's military and nuclear sites. They follow weekend strikes by the U.S. on three Iranian nuclear facilities, including Fordow and Natanz. Some residents of Guam say they're concerned after learning the island was used as a decoy by the Pentagon in the lead-up to the U.S. military's attack on Iran. As Nina Rao reports, Joint Chiefs Chairman Dan Kane said B-52 stealth bombers were flown to Guam to draw attention away from the bombing mission.
That news has left some indigenous Chamorro residents uneasy, especially those who have long criticized Guam's use as a staging ground for U.S. military operations. Maria Hernandez is co-director of the community group Micronesia Climate Change Alliance.
It's definitely scary, I think, especially those of us who are mothers. We're kind of like so used to hearing about the threats. It's actually a little bit depressing to think about.
The U.S. military owns about a third of Guam's land. Chamorro advocates like Hernandez say the island's political status leaves residents vulnerable and often without a say. For NPR News, I'm Nina Rao in Guam.
This is NPR News. A federal judge in Tennessee is ordering the release of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. He's the Maryland man who was wrongly deported to El Salvador and then returned to the U.S. to face criminal charges. Mariana Bacallao with member station WPLN has more from Nashville.
The judge has ordered that Abrego Garcia be released as he awaits trial on human smuggling charges. But the 29-year-old who was wrongly deported from Maryland to El Salvador in March may go into ICE custody instead, officials say. In her ruling, the judge writes that the government failed to prove that Abrego Garcia was a flight risk. Prosecutors say that Abrego Garcia smuggled people without legal status for the MS-13 gang. The defense says that the charges are to distract from the lack of due process in Abrego Garcia's case. The conditions of his release will be discussed at a hearing scheduled for Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
It's going to be hot this week over much of the central and eastern U.S. Heat advisories and extreme heat warnings are in effect in about 24 states, from Louisiana to Wisconsin and the Carolinas to New England. The National Weather Service says Augusta, Maine will likely be at or near 100 degrees by tomorrow afternoon. Stocks on Wall Street opened lower moments ago. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. The Trump administration has declared its attack on Iran's nuclear sites a success. Experts outside the administration, though, are questioning how well the strikes worked. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
It was called Operation Midnight Hammer. Seven B-2 stealth bombers took off from an airbase in Missouri loaded with bunker-busting bombs. They flew 18 hours to Iran, where they dropped their weapons on two sites that had been used to enrich uranium. A submarine launched cruise missiles at a third site.
Iran's nuclear ambitions have been obliterated.
That was Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth speaking at a Pentagon press conference yesterday. Outside experts aren't as sure. Satellite images show where the bunker busters hit, but it's hard to say if they really destroyed the underground facilities, according to Jeffrey Lewis.
what you see is actually very difficult to interpret because it's really just some holes.
Lewis is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies who's watched Iran's sites using satellite images, and those pictures show something else. In the days running up to the strike, vehicles were visible at two of the three facilities struck by the U.S.
One of the really interesting things I see is that the Iranians had time to bring trucks to the facility, which I presume allowed them to shut things down and remove things. And then they buried the entrances to both facilities with dirt to protect them.
The two facilities in question were believed to hold much of Iran's highly enriched uranium. That uranium was almost weapons grade, and it's believed Iran had enough for around 10 nuclear bombs before the strike. Much of it was stored in small portable canisters.
They're metal. They can be put in a car.
David Albright is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Like Lewis, he's seen the images, and he thinks the uranium has left these sites.
I think you have to assume that significant amounts of this enriched uranium still exist and remains a problem. So this is not over by any means.
And that's not all. Lewis and Albright also think that Iran has more machines used to enrich uranium and other underground sites where they could potentially install those machines. While Iran's nuclear program has definitely been damaged, Lewis says he doubts military force alone can destroy it.
I don't think any bombing campaign is going to eliminate Iran's nuclear program.
Instead, he says that diplomacy may be the only way to make Iran give up its nuclear ambitions. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
For more on the aftermath of the U.S. strikes on Iran, we're joined now by Farzan Sabet. He's a managing researcher at the Geneva Graduate Institute. That's an institute focused on international affairs and diplomacy. And he is an authority on Iran and Middle East security. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Sabet.
Good morning. Happy to be on.
So President Trump said these three nuclear facilities were obliterated. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth took it further, saying Iran's nuclear ambitions were obliterated. Based on your knowledge of Iran's sort of security apparatus and sort of framework, do you think that that's true?
I think it's a mixed picture. So, of course, the impact of bombing on has meaningfully set back Iran's ability to quickly acquire nuclear, to acquire weapons-grade uranium, which would need to build a bomb. But critically, Iran still retains its roughly 400-kilogram stockpile of high-enriched uranium, or HEU, which is enriched to around 60%, as well as backup facilities and centrifuge capacity that could be up and running in as little as a few weeks or months. I've seen some estimates that say Iran would be able to use its 400 kilograms of HEU to create enough weapons-grade uranium for 9 to 10 weapons in as little as 6 months.
Did you say weeks or months to recover from these strikes?
Potentially. Huh. Now, that'll depend on, you know, state capacity and kind of degradation of leadership. But, certainly.
Huh. Interesting. So I want to hear more about that, but before we do, I wanted to know whether you thought there might have been any downside to striking these nuclear facilities. And I mean, you can take that in whatever direction you want, either environmental or perhaps in how it might stimulate, you know, Iran's nuclear ambitions even further.
Certainly. Well, as far as I'm aware, there's no irradiated material there, so there's not necessarily going to be much radiological risk. However, material like uranium hexafluoride, which very well could have been present at these sites, could pose a chemical toxicity risk to humans and living organisms if it's dispersed into nearby water sources or if they contaminate the environment surrounding at least one or two of those facilities. Beyond that, of course, this certainly increases the Islamic Republic's motivation to attempt to build the bomb if it wasn't motivated before, right, since the breakout of this war. And finally, just from a perspective of international law and setting a precedent, I think a lot of other countries are going to be looking at their own nuclear options and whether they should try to at least initiate the process of being able to acquire one so that they don't face a similar fate in the future.
Say more about that. Why do you say that?
I mean, the Islamic Republic itself has looked to past examples like Libya, right? The case of Libya being a country which negotiated away its nuclear capacity in order to normalize relations with the West, and specifically the United States. Of course, the moment that Libya became weakened following the uprisings of the Arab Spring, NATO intervened, contributing to the collapse of that regime. The Islamic Republic's own kind of approach to its nuclear option has been informed by the Libyan experience. And of course, if it had been further on the pathway to acquiring a nuclear weapon, it might have actually been able to forestall this eventuality. At least that's kind of the narrative coming out of Tehran and many inside of Iran. And now there's a huge push inside the country to say, well, either test a weapon or let's make a deal, right? But it's put huge upward pressure. And again, a lot of other countries are going to, I think, in light of this, think that, well, perhaps the only way to really guarantee our security will be to build a bomb.
The Trump administration's argument seems to be it would be the other way, that the threat of this kind of response by Israel and the United States would argue against pursuing those ambitions. And you just don't buy that.
Well, if they succeed. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think while the strikes on these three facilities can be read as a success in a narrow sense, right, we still don't know the full scale of the destruction. And I think most experts will agree that Iran retains a significant nuclear capacity.
And before we let you go, as briefly as you can, would Iran have made any accommodation to the potential environmental or human hazard resulting from the destruction of those facilities? Would they have taken that into account as briefly as you can?
I think certainly they would have.
That is Farzad Sabet. He's an expert on Iran. He's a managing researcher at the Geneva Graduate Institute. Mr. Sabet, thank you so much for sharing these insights with us. I do hope we'll talk again.
Pleasure to be on.
Former Senator Carol Moseley Braun is a lot of firsts. She was the first African-American woman elected to the Senate, the first Black Democrat elected to the Senate, and the first female senator from Illinois. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, a conversation with Carol Moseley Braun about her new memoir and the high cost of being the first. Listen on your smart speaker in the NPR app or on this public radio station. This is NPR News.
After an ALS diagnosis, Zac Brown Band founding member John Driscoll Hopkins has a new song. He wrote it for his children. He'll share it with us next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. 20 years ago, this weekend, Taco Bell debuted the Crunchwrap Supreme, yet another of its combinations of meat, cheese, lettuce, sour cream, and tortillas, this time shaped like an octagon. The New York Times has a rundown of all the chefs who have been inspired by the Crunchwrap. One uses Sichuan spices in theirs, another Korean barbecue, chicken shawarma, flaming hot Cheetos. Given Taco Bell already uses Dorito shells, that one might actually make it on the menu. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. NATO allies are gathering in the Netherlands for a summit tomorrow as Russia continues its war on Ukraine and days after President Trump joined Israel in striking Iran. The Trump administration suggested the president might skip it if other members of the alliance did not agree to massively boost their defense spending. NATO did reach an agreement yesterday, which officials hope will mean smooth sailing later this week. Here's reporter Terry Schultz.
NATO's summit in The Hague will be dominated by two figures, Donald Trump and the number 5.
5% is our message, and we will deliver that. President Trump at The Hague at the summit.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth at NATO headquarters in early June, already confident the other 31 NATO countries would agree to raise military expenditures to 5% of their GDP, more than double their current investment for many. And except for Spain, which has negotiated a special lower rate, allies will deliver the deal on Wednesday, pledging to hit the mark by 2035. Secretary General Mark Rutte, who made it his mission to secure the spending surge, regularly rejects suggestions its primary purpose is to keep the U.S. on board. He insists the agreement is not about pleasing one person, but about protecting the 1 billion citizens in NATO territory.
What we see is Russia rapidly reconstituting itself. We see a massive Chinese build-up of its military, and that is what this summit is all about. Much more defense spending, so that we are able, indeed, to defend ourselves.
But some observers aren't convinced this urgent pledge represents an upgrade in real capabilities.
The 5% number is an absurdity.
Longtime NATO watcher Paul Taylor, now a senior fellow at the European Policy Center think tank in Brussels.
I think we're giving the United States, and President Trump specifically, a rod with which to beat us. And I think that it takes no account of the quality of military spending. It takes no account of whether it's spent efficiently by procuring weapons together, or whether it's spent inefficiently by everybody going to their national champion for more of the same weapons.
Economist Guntram Wolf with the Bruegel think tank also has doubts the plan is a practical one. He says it doesn't make sense to try to force countries far from the front line of Russia's war against Ukraine to invest huge amounts in heavy arms.
There's really a scarcity of material in the market, a scarcity of produced weapons. And those weapons that are being bought at the moment, they should really be bought by countries that need them the most, and that tend to be the countries from Germany to Finland, essentially.
But those are questions to be examined after Wednesday's summit, which has been pared down to a single session, with the final document a single page, to reduce the possibilities for political disruptions. Potential disagreements over references to Russia and Ukraine have been resolved by barely mentioning them. This meeting is all about investment. Europeans hoping their budget boosts earn long-term interest from Trump. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The proposed reconciliation bill before the Senate includes deep cuts to the National Park Service. More than $260 million allocated for park staffing would be stripped from an agency already burdened by shortages. The bill also requires the sale of public lands and expanded oil and gas drilling leases. Now, as the Park Service enters its busiest season, staff shortages are putting fragile ecosystems at risk and hurting local economies. I recently visited Joshua Tree National Park and met some of the people most affected. Susan Burnett is the owner of the Mojave Sands Motel in the town of Joshua Tree, California, just minutes away from the entrance of the national park.
Well, I'll just show you the room. I like to use and reuse stuff. And that kind of is a part of desert living, right?
The motel's five rooms look out onto a courtyard with desert landscaping and a fish pond that attracts dozens of bird species. She says all the local businesses rely on the park.
Everybody that comes to my motel goes to the park, even if they came here for something else, you know. So the park is everything to us.
Across the country, the park system supports more than 400,000 jobs in nearby communities, mostly in the hospitality and restaurant industry. Burnett worries that some local businesses will not make it through the summer. She says this year has been different.
I would say at any given time of the year, between 25 and 40% of my business is international travelers. I have had less than 10 international travelers this spring season, which is incredibly low.
The Park Service was already understaffed when President Trump froze hiring across all federal agencies on his first day in office. The NPS then faced layoffs in February in a purge that also included other government departments. Following public outcry, the administration announced that it would lift the hiring freeze for thousands of seasonal workers, and Interior Secretary Doug Burgum issued an order that all parks and services must remain open.
The administration is working in overdrive to essentially deceive the public into thinking that things are okay at our parks.
Neil Desai is with the National Parks Conservation Association, a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates on behalf of the national parks.
It's just bizarre. It's tough to tell how anyone can see this as smart politics to mess around with our national parks.
Polls show that Americans across the political spectrum rate the National Park Service as the government's most trusted agency. It accounts for less than 1% of the federal budget, and in 2023, visitor spending contributed more than $55 billion to the U.S. economy, according to a report from the Department of the Interior. Desai says to downsize an agency that actually brings in revenue doesn't make any sense.
They should actually be promoted as a model of efficiency, how much economic return they bring into our local communities and support jobs and, right, economy, right?
Park rangers are on the front lines of this downsizing, and they're under a lot of pressure. About a mile up a dirt road on the edge of Joshua Tree National Park, I met a ranger who wanted to remain anonymous.
There's a lot of fear and retribution of people losing their jobs without due process. Under normal circumstances, it would be totally easy and allowed for me to talk to a journalist about how much I love this national park and how important it is to preserve it. That is part of my job, and nowadays we're stifled and we're afraid to speak.
We ducked under a barbed wire fence and walked toward huge piles of sandy-colored boulders as he told us about the park.
And we are just walking up to the edge of the habitat where Joshua trees grow in the park. You might see jackrabbits or white-tailed or cottontail rabbits. You might see a desert tortoise. It's a really resourceful, special organisms out here that tend to find unusual ways to survive in the desert.
He says park staff is struggling to fill in for colleagues who have been fired or accepted the government's deferred resignation offer.
Try telling a park ranger who works and sweats all day that their job is low productivity. But that being said, people that were resilient, that have worked for this park for 20, 25 years, they're looking around and saying, I'm going to go find another job, because they are so beaten down by this onslaught of attacks on the mission of the Park Service.
The Park Service declined to be interviewed for this piece and wrote in a statement to NPR, quote, It's not unusual or unique to this year for questions to come up about staffing or for the staffing needs to fluctuate. As in other years, we are working hard to make it another great year for visitors. Joshua Tree gets hundreds of thousands of visitors each summer. In a park the size of Rhode Island, being understaffed means a much longer response time if someone gets hurt or lost, and fewer rangers to keep visitors safe in triple-digit heat.
This is the time of year when people die in the desert because people's bodies aren't adjusted for that heat. They're not ready for it. And so we're at risk of having those kinds of tragedies occur because there's fewer people out protecting you.
In a statement to NPR, the National Park Service wrote, travelers visiting national parks this summer should do their due diligence by planning for their trip, and referred us to NPS resources for health, safety, and emergency planning. The park ranger we spoke to says the work that visitors do not see is now being neglected, such as the conservation work of biologists and archaeologists who study and preserve what makes parks extraordinary. If this work isn't prioritized, the damage to ecosystems could be irreversible.
You might visit a place that you visited 20 years ago and you might say, hey, this doesn't look like what I remembered.
He says the government is short-sighted in its efforts to remake the Park Service.
They don't understand that the reason people come to Joshua Tree National Park is to see Joshua trees. They don't understand that the reason people come to Sequoia National Park is to see sequoias, and Glacier National Park to see the glaciers. They don't see the economic value, the cultural value, the biodiversity of these places is all the same thing. It's all wrapped up in this one thing we call a national park. That is such a huge part of what makes America beautiful.
He says he still sees a possibility to make a better world and a better park service, and that he is speaking out and risking his job for that future. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin.